Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Eyewitness to Occupation panel, sponsored by Students Against War, which is the broad-based anti-war coalition on campus, and Burlington Anti-War Coalition, the equivalent in for the community in downtown Burlington. The panel is also endorsed by the International Socialist Organization, Vermonters for Just Peace in Palestine, Israel, and Students for Peace and Global Justice. I'd like to introduce the speakers. The first will be Kari Peterson-Smith, who recently returned from Iraq, where he represented the Campus Anti-War Network on a peace delegation organized by United for Peace and Justice, Global Exchange, and Occupation Watch. And he's a Campus Anti-War Network student organizer at New York's Rochester Institute of Technology. And he'll be speaking about the occupation of Iraq, obviously, which I think we've seen kind of remains the Achilles heel of the U.S. empire. And basically is the only fetter to the U.S. going on, as we've seen, to Iran or other places, in reshaping the entire Middle East in its image of a U.S. corporate-run free trade zone in the Middle East. And then Kim Eid, who recently returned from a trip to Palestine to witness the Israeli occupation there and network with Palestinian activists. And the issue of Palestine has recently come to the fore again in the U.S. anti-war movement, really for the first time with a letter that was sent to the anti-war movement, signed onto by over 200 Arab and Muslim organizations in the U.S., which really brought to the fore the fact that the occupation of Palestine and Iraq are linked not only by tactics, but by a U.S. foreign policy that aims to use both to kind of conquer the Middle East, and brought up the way Arabs and Muslims in the anti-war movement have been marginalized by saying, don't bring up Palestine. Without further ado, I'd like to hand it over to Kari.
Thank you. I'm on a bit of a speaking tour through the Campus Anti-War Network right now. And the title of the tour is called Eyewitness to Empire. And really, every empire throughout history has their own kind of ideological justification for why they're doing what they're doing. People are probably familiar with the white man's burden, which was the idea during the British Empire that it was the role of the British to go around the world and civilize the peoples of Asia and Africa, to bring civilization to them. And of course, the American Empire today has its own ideological justification, or justifiers who try to justify it. And I think that actually the New York Times has been doing a great job of giving this pro-colonial cover for what the U.S. is doing around the world. I just want to read briefly from yesterday's editorial page. This part of the editorial starts out by talking about how the Bush administration's logic for the war was that there was an imminent threat with weapons of mass destruction and whatnot. And really, the logic of justifying this empire is a bit of both the white man's burden and the idea that there are these imminent threats that the U.S. has to neutralize. No imminent threat was found, but Iraq's scientists clearly know how to make those weapons, and if continued chaos leads to a new dictatorship, covert work might resume. This gives America a practical interest in developing stable democratic structures that can outlast American military occupation. The editor then goes on to talk about why the U.S. needs to do what it's doing in Haiti, and I'll spare you most of the paragraph, but I'll just read the first sentence. Haiti has been a failed state almost from its start 200 years ago. The concluding paragraph goes like this. Functioning nations cannot be conjured into existence by foreign occupiers. They must be put together primarily from within. But in shattered societies like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Haiti, no internal effort can get far without a substantial and sustained outside commitment. So I want to be clear about the key force that's shattering Iraqi society right now is actually the U.S. occupation. And I went and saw that firsthand this January, and I want to talk about really how the occupation is affecting the lives of every person in Iraq who I met in big and small ways. In big ways as when a loved one gets killed or detained by U.S. forces, in smaller but still more important ways as if you're a student and you're trying to study for an exam and then the lights go out and so you have to study by candlelight or what have you. But everyone is affected by the occupation in these big and small ways. And really what I want to do tonight is share with you the conversations that I had and the experiences that I had about this, how this occupation is affecting Iraqis and why I think it's so important that we do what we can here to end the occupation immediately. I want to start with Tariq, who was my driver from Amman to Baghdad. You can't unfortunately, you can't book a United Airlines flight into Iraq. You have to fly to an outside country and then drive in. And so we flew to Amman, Jordan, and a man named Tadek drove us the 13-hour drive to Baghdad. And I didn't know a whole lot about Iraq, so we had 13 hours for me to learn. Tadek was actually like many Iraqis who I would meet in that he initially wasn't opposed to a U.S. invasion. He was hoping that it would bring an end to years of war and suffering. And I think that it's important to understand what's going on in Iraq now in the context, in a little historical context, that is, Iraq has had 35 years of dictatorship and 20 years of war, beginning in the 1980s with a war with Iran that was really catastrophic. Upwards of 1 million people were killed between Iran and Iraq. And of course, during that time, the United States was Iraq's staunch ally in arming Saddam Hussein against the Iranians. So that was a catastrophic war in which said that every family in Iraq lost someone during that war. So across the board, devastating. In 1991, the United States, of course, invaded Iraq, turning on its ally, and killed between 100,000 and 200,000 Iraqis. Civilian infrastructure was targeted, things like sewer plants, water treatment plants, electrical facilities, and things like that were targeted. So that was another devastating war. During that invasion, I shouldn't call it a war, it was a one-sided slaughter. During that invasion, the United States imposed an embargo on Iraq, saying that certain goods couldn't be traded with the country, and this was known as economic sanctions. This was done through the United Nations, and it kept out all kinds of supplies, including diapers, pencils, ambulances, things that were obviously for civilian use but could be used to make weapons of mass destruction. So I don't know how you'd fashion diapers into weapons of mass destruction, but that was their logic, and that embargo actually lasted for 13 years. And through the course of that time, it was responsible for the death by the UN's own statistics of 1.5 million Iraqis. So phenomenally devastating, even more so than the 91 invasion. And during that 13-year period, actually, between 1991 and up through last year, the United States and Britain were actually flying bombing missions over Iraq. And this is something that we really didn't hear about at all in the United States. But the U.S. and British aircraft were patrolling the so-called no-fly zones, where Iraqi planes couldn't fly, but American and British ones could. And they were bombing Iraq sometimes on a weekly basis. And so that was devastating, too. So it's really been 20 years of siege that Iraqis have been living under. And last year, as Bush got up and said, you know, we're going to bring freedom and liberate Iraq, Tadek and other Iraqis I met were hoping that Bush would keep to his word and actually bring about some sort of peace, you know, the idea that it couldn't get worse. And what Tadek told me is that actually the invasion just brought about more suffering. And I think that it's important to understand what this means for Iraqis like Tadek. That is, The run-up to the invasion for me last year, and I think for a lot of you too, I knew that this was going to be a bad thing. I didn't see any good coming out of this invasion. People like Tadek actually had some high hopes, and so it's not just the anger that I feel. It's a sense of betrayal that he was told one thing, and actually the everyday reality is another thing entirely. During the invasion, Tadek's brother was killed. And then he told me about his experience under the occupation, during which the United States has failed to bring work, reconstruct infrastructure, restore electricity, clean water, or security to the country, and about how the economy is really in shambles. The last statistic I read, which was a month or so ago, in the London-based Guardian, was that unemployment in Iraq is at 80%. So absolutely devastating. And that's really the state of things, as Tadek told me. And he told me, you know, we just want to live. He told me about how much he loves his country, how he wants to live in Iraq, but he said, we don't want the Army USA. You know, we don't want the U.S. military here patrolling us. So as we were driving, the things that Tadek told me about Iraq gave me a lot of insight into what the occupation means for people, but it was really nothing compared to actually seeing the occupation with my own eyes. When we crossed into the country, I saw U.S. troops for the first time, and we were on this road to Baghdad, and there was an armored vehicle with a soldier sticking out of the top of it, but behind a huge gun, and the soldier was wearing a ski mask. He looked terrifying, obviously. I could only imagine how Iraqis view these soldiers as they occupy their country. There was another vehicle in front of that one with another soldier and another huge gun, and then I saw the reason why. They were on the road, a long convoy of oil tanker trucks stretched out in front of them, and they were actually escorting them on the way to Baghdad. And in front of the convoy, there was another couple of escort vehicles. I should take this opportunity to just talk a bit about the oil and gas situation in Iraq. As this suggests, the United States is actually importing gasoline and oil into Iraq. Now, you may think this is a little strange because Iraq actually has the second largest proven oil reserves in the world. And what this means is that the price of gasoline has skyrocketed. I was told upwards of 2,000%. And we actually had to stop for gas on the way. And we had to wait 45 minutes in line because there's a shortage of gasoline right now in Iraq. So just take a second to think about what it would mean to wait 45 minutes in Burlington for gas. You know, it's unthinkable. It's even more unimaginable in Iraq, where the country, you know, as Paul Wolfowitz said, the country is swimming in oil. And Iraqis know how much oil their country has, and this is a real source of anger and contempt for the occupation that Iraqis have. By the way, the 45-minute wait was nothing. In the city of Baghdad, people are waiting 5 and 6 hours for gas. And actually, I heard from several people that people are driving to gas stations at night with blankets and thermoses so they can sleep over and get gasoline in the morning. As we got closer to the city, we passed the Abu Ghraib prison. And it looked terrifying, as prisons do. You know, it's a huge structure with razor wire everywhere and guard towers. And this was the most notorious prison under Saddam Hussein's regime. Now it's the main detention facility of the United States. I think that says something. Essentially, the prison was four big fortified walls and then inside a big courtyard. And in the courtyard are plastic tents, and these are where the prisoners stay. In the summer, when it gets up to 120 degrees, they stay in these plastic tents. In the winter, when I was there, when it was down below freezing, they were in these plastic tents. Once we entered the city, I was really blown away by the sight of bombed out buildings throughout, you know, everywhere. And I took photos of them, but when I got my pictures back, it was actually disappointing because there's nothing that can really compare to being in front of a 15-story building that's a shell because it was bombed out. And yet it still stands. Among the buildings that I saw that were completely destroyed were the Ministry of Culture, a supermarket, an apartment building, and the telephone exchange. So, you know, apartments of mass destruction. You know, these are not regime targets that we were told were targeted by the U.S. The effects of that embargo, the economic sanctions, were actually a lot more widespread throughout the city. While there are bombed out buildings throughout the city, really every building, every structure there is crumbling. Because basic construction materials weren't allowed in the country. You know, it was devastating. And so the city's falling apart, infrastructure and different systems like electrical and sewer systems that were kind of hanging by a thread snapped during the invasion last year. So throughout the city of Baghdad, there are pools of sewage in the streets. And you really get the sense that this is a majestic city. Baghdad in Iraq is the birthplace of civilization. This is the place, the Fertile Crescent that we learned about in elementary school. This is where civilization came from, and there's sewage flowing in the streets. And what this means for the people who live there, it's absolutely devastating to see in such a short span of time their city go to this state. We also passed on our way driving in the Baghdad Hotel, which is where the Iraqi Governing Council is based. And the Iraqi Governing Council is a group of people handpicked by the United States to give some sense of legitimacy to the occupation. Just so you know, the hotel was surrounded by barbed wire, tanks, machine gun nests, and huge signs that said no photography. So this is the democracy that the United States is bringing to Iraq. It was very clear that this is just another military dictatorship. One has been replaced with another. Once we were in the city, we hooked up with Occupation Watch, which is an anti-occupation nonprofit based in Baghdad who's really doing amazing work. And they arranged our itinerary throughout the week. The first meeting that we had was with a family who lost someone to U.S. forces, and so I want to tell you a bit about that. The family who lost their loved one invited us in and sat us down, and his brother told us the story. The incident happened on September 22nd. The man, whose name is Ahmed Khalif Salman, was accused of being part of the resistance, the Iraqi resistance, and really that's all it takes is an accusation to warrant a U.S. home invasion. The troops came at 3 in the morning. They blocked off his street with tanks, and then they moved in. One of them kicked down the outside door, and when Ahmed opened the front door, they shot him in the chest immediately. He was still alive. They brought him outside in the front yard and let him bleed in the front yard while they went into his house and ransacked it. They terrorized his family, yelled at his wife and children to get out of bed and for them to go into the front yard. And then they ransacked the house. They broke furniture. They stole jewelry, and they stole money. Outside in the yard, Ahmed's 13-year-old son, who we met, was asking, "Why are you doing this to my father? What are you doing?" And the soldiers tied him up and put him on the ground. After they were done ransacking the house, the soldiers left the house. Ahmed was still alive. They wrapped his wound crudely, grabbed him by his feet, and dragged him to one of their vehicles, threw him in, and then took off. And his family didn't know where they took him to. So the next day, they went looking. They went to hospitals and detention centers, and finally at one hospital, they found out that he had died, and the soldiers had dropped off his body there. And so they picked him up there. And Ahmed was 46 years old, and he had 5 children. His family lives with his brother now. That's where we heard this story. And his children, of course, they're terrified to sleep in the house where their father was killed. So this is an example of the U.S. going to detain someone and they end up killing him. The detentions are something that we're really not hearing about at all here in the States. And I don't have enough time to go into some of the other stories that I heard about detentions, but suffice it to say that really it was the same story over and over again, that the troops come in the middle of the night, they kick down the door, they usually throw in a sound grenade or something like that to startle a family, they terrorize the people, they get them out of bed, they ransack the house and they loot it. It sounds like this is standard procedure, looting the house, stealing jewelry and stealing money. We know that this war was sold with a lot of lies, you know, weapons of mass destruction, links to Al-Qaeda and things like that. One of the myths that I don't think has been addressed enough is the idea that this was a clean invasion. I remember listening to a New York Times reporter, actually, who was in Baghdad saying, he was on the radio and he was saying, you know, regardless of your feelings on the war, you have to admit that the invasion was done with surgical precision, that the U.S. really took care to spare civilians and really only target the regime. And this is an absolute lie, and I just want to address that really quickly. First of all, the United States used cluster bombs when bombing Baghdad. Baghdad's a city of 4 million people. Cluster bombs, as it sounds like, they're big bombs that have clusters of little bombs inside of them. They explode and scatter over a wide area, these little bombs. And the whole idea, obviously, is to kill and maim as many people as possible. These are not surgical weapons. Moreover, there were civilians in Baghdad who were actually murdered during the invasion. And we met a woman named Vivian Salim who told us her story of what happened to her family. I just want to share that with you. On April 7th, her neighborhood came under attack by U.S. bombs, and so she and her husband, Nadim, got their children into the car to flee the area. They were driving through the city, and they turned down one street, and they found a couple of U.S. tanks in their path. And the tanks opened fire immediately and ended up killing her entire family, her husband and her 3 children. One of the people in our delegation asked if they fired any warning shots, and she broke down crying as she told us that the first shots they fired landed in her son's face. I want to, Vivian made these flyers with her family's pictures on them, and she wanted people in the United States to see them, to see what they looked like. You know, these aren't terrorists, they're not weapons of mass destruction, they're not regime targets, they're human beings who are caught in the crossfire, who are caught in the middle of Bush's plans for oil and empire. So her whole family was killed. She was able to flee the area. I apologize. I don't know if I have enough for everyone. So these are some of the horror stories that I heard while I was there. One of the things that really struck me was the contempt with which the United States is carrying out this occupation. The fact that the U.S. uses Saddam's old palaces and his regime's old buildings. Paul Bremer III, who was the U.S.'s viceroy of Iraq, essentially. He lives in one of Saddam's old palaces. The fact that there's this bomb shelter in a neighborhood called Adamiya that was actually in the 91 Gulf War. It was bombed. It's a bomb shelter. It's a place where civilians were hiding from bombing, and the U.S. actually targeted it and bombed these people on Valentine's Day 1991, and they incinerated 400 people alive. And that place has been preserved as kind of a memorial to those people. And it's really, I went there, and it's really kind of a sacred place. It's this place where these people were killed by U.S. bombs. And it was being maintained as this memorial by an Islamic organization, And a few weeks before we came in January, U.S. soldiers actually went into the place and kicked out this Islamic organization. So they went in with their guns, you know, and they just showed such contempt for this place that's really sacred ground. So that's the kind of contempt with which the occupation is being carried out. The greatest example I saw was actually there's a monument called the Al-Shahid Monument, which is a memorial to all the veterans or the soldiers who were killed in the Iran-Iraq War. And like I said, this war was absolutely catastrophic for Iraqis. And this memorial is of tremendous emotional significance. I mean, the only thing that I think is comparable in the States is the Vietnam Wall, you know, and what that means to people emotionally. And so it's a very special place, and now it's occupied. It's a U.S. base. You know, so Iraqis can't go there. It's surrounded by barbed wire and tanks and the like. So that's the kind of contempt with which the occupation is being carried out by the people who are running the show. And I think that trickles down to some of the troops over there who were told that they were going to liberate these people, and instead they find themselves occupying them. And they're resentful. They're frustrated. They're far from home. And they signed up. They joined the army to get money for education or whatever. And now they find themselves occupying Iraq. And so when I was there, I saw troops pointing their guns at children. You know, that's the kind of contempt that Iraqis are dealing with. And I would argue that this kind of contempt and this stomping on Iraqi people's dignity, day in and day out, that's what feeds the resistance. We're told here that there are terrorists or there are Islamists or there are Iranians and Syrians who are in the background kind of pulling the strings of the resistance. It's actually the occupation itself is forcing people. People who don't consider themselves to be political people, people who are trying to avoid confrontation, find themselves confronted every single hour of every single day by this occupation. And you know, I don't in this presentation, I don't want to portray Iraqis as these one-dimensional victims. Life goes on for people. If you have work, you go to work. If you're a student, you go to school. People live with incredible dignity and warmth. And, you know, they're just amazing people, but All of that is squelched at every turn by the occupation, and that's what's forcing people in the resistance. And we actually spoke with psychology professors at one point who were telling us about the indignity of living under occupation, and one of them was just kind of going off in this laundry list of what it means to live under occupation, and he concluded by saying, you know, sooner or later we'll all be part of the resistance because there's no hope. That's significant coming from an academic. I mean, can you imagine like a professor at UVM considering taking up arms because that's the state of things in their country. That's the extent to which they're losing control of their lives and of their country. So that's why I think that it's so important here in the United States that we build an anti-war movement that calls for the end of the occupation, bring the troops home, and let Iraqis decide how to run their own country. The United Nations, people may know, sent a mission over to decide if Iraqis could have elections by the March, or I'm sorry, the June 30th deadline when the United States is supposed to hand over power to Iraq. And they concluded that Iraq wasn't ready for elections. And one of the reasons they cited was that Iraq doesn't have a democratic culture. You know, as if the United States has a democratic culture, right? You know, I think that this is racism. You know, this is the white man's burden all over again. The idea that George Bush, who actually wasn't elected, if I remember correctly, can go over to Iraq and teach them how to have democracy is absurd, and we need to expose that for what it is. So one of the things that I actually, probably the greatest lesson that I drew in Iraq was the importance of organization, of people pulling together and actually organizing. I met Iraqis who had all kinds of opinions, people who thought that the occupation should end, but they weren't sure what should happen next. Some people thought that maybe Saddam should come back, he's not so bad compared to this. Other people saying, you know, Saddam can't come back. People had all kinds of opinions, but the vast majority of people weren't involved in any kind of party or any kind of organization. And there was a certain sense of tragedy to it that you know, really all people can do, unless you're actually organized with other people and trying to put forth your alternative to the situation that you find yourself in, all you can do is be a commentator on the history that's made by other people, you know, history that's either made for you or against you. That really says something to me about what's going on in Iraq, that Iraqis need to pull together and organize against this occupation. I think here in the United States, we have to get our act together and organize as well in building this movement. So I want to kind of conclude that, you know, we know right now that Iraq has an underground armed resistance. What's needed, I think, to complement that is an above-ground political opposition to the occupation that all kinds of Iraqis can tap into and actually be part of a discussion to figure out what is it going to take to get the United States out of our country, to take our country back. And I would argue that we actually need the same here in the United States. We need an above-ground political opposition to the occupation. And I would argue a real opposition. I think that, and we should talk about this in the discussion, it's important to say that, you know, this is an election year, and the front runner for the Democratic Party, the person who's probably going to get the nomination, was adamantly for the invasion, is adamantly for the occupation. So I don't think it's about finding someone to vote for who will carry out this fight for us. It's about us actually getting together and doing that wherever we are. If you're at UVM, you know, I encourage you to join SAW. If you're in Burlington, join BOC. I love that name. But that's really what we have to do. And please, you know, everyone should go to New York City on March 20th. The International Day of Action Against the War. It's important to show that people around the world are still opposed to what the U.S. did, but actually here in the United States, it's so crucial to show that we don't stand with our government, that we actually stand against what they're doing around the world in our names. So in conclusion, we in Iraq and in the United States need both action and discussion about what it's going to take to fight U.S. imperialism, how to fight for the right of an occupied people to take control of their country and their lives. And I think that as us doing that, as us getting together to be part of that discussion and action here, we'll actually be part of a greater discussion of how to take control of our country and our lives. Thank you.
Kind of eerie to hear the stories of Iraq, because it could so easily be Palestine and just replace U.S. forces with Israeli forces, and we could leave the money all the same because it's U.S. money going to Israel and going to Iraq. I went to Israel and Palestine 2.5 weeks ago for many reasons. One was to go with a friend of mine who was doing research for a thesis about the effectiveness of internationals going abroad and doing nonviolent interventions. So we interviewed 8 different organizations in Palestine and talked to many people about that principle of nonviolent interventions. I also went to see what my tax dollars are going to, and I spoke with some Israelis as soon as I got there. I flew into Tel Aviv, and I spoke with a friend of a friend, and she told me about her time in the military. She's like 29 years old. She was in the military. Every 18-year-old in Israel has to go into the military, so forced service. And she was in the military for 2 years, and following that 2-year stint, she left. And she went to London for 7 years. And it took her 7 years to get over what she did while she was in the military for 2 years. She took over homes of Palestinians. She saw her friends' legs blown off in minefields. She couldn't handle it and didn't know what to do, and she had to leave. And she returned back to Israel because she felt the only thing she could do was teach and educate children, and she opened a Montessori school for elementary school kids and is hoping to open one for both Arab and Israeli students. So no one leaves this occupation unscathed, including the Israelis and including the internationals that go over there and return and have to see the news and hear about villages and friends that they've just met being hurt, being arrested, being deported, and having a real connection with the communities there and not being able to do anything except stand in front of an audience like you and tell about what I just saw. And of course, the Palestinians definitely are not walking away from this unscathed, not even the infants that are just born yesterday. So my trip began in Tel Aviv, and I went into Jerusalem, and about an hour before I got there, a bus had been blown up, and everybody was freaking out, and you know, the conversations at the hostel were all about what was going on, and it was a really vibrant conversation, political conversation. And we were told to go to different places and visit different people, and we went to a place called Qalqilya. And Qalqilya, which I'll show pictures of, some of these stories soon, is a city. It was a bustling, huge city of, I think, 43,000 people, close to the size of Burlington. And it's completely surrounded by a huge wall and security fence, the whole city. And you can't just go directly in there. You have to go through checkpoints and roadblocks. And it's a mess. And the people there are living their lives and doing their everyday things. But they're also resisting. They're demonstrating. They're spray painting that wall. And they're trying to live as normally as they can. We were staying with the International Solidarity Movement in Qalqilya. It's an organization that brings internationals to Palestine to do nonviolent intervention. And we had an opportunity to meet with five different families of prisoners. So we went to the prisoners' homes, and it was holiday season. It's Eid, was the holiday. And we went into each home and had cookies and tea and coffee and cookies and tea and coffee and cookies and tea and coffee. And after five homes, you know, I think I gained 5 pounds. So we sat and talked to these people, and we heard about the arrests of their loved ones, of brothers and sisters, or mostly brothers, actually, brothers and sons. And the reason that they were arrested was mostly out of the four, I think three out of the four had shot a military officer. Now, shooting a military officer is horrendous. How could you shoot a military officer? Many had seen their brother been killed, their best friend killed by a military officer days, hours before, and this was their response. And I was thinking, well, if I was in the United States and I shot a police officer, I'd go to jail or I'd be killed, and that would be that, and the end of it, I'd be gone. So, you know, what can I really do for these people? And I took a few steps back, and I thought about it a little bit and realized, wait a minute, time out. They're fighting a war. This is self-defense. They're fighting for their sovereignty. They're fighting for their land. And they're fighting for their brother to not get shot by a military officer. So thinking about this a little bit more, I sat back and realized these people are prisoners of war, yet they're not getting any of the prisoner of war treatment that prisoners get. And they haven't spoken with their family maybe in 13, 18 years, you know, and their families are freaking out. And two out of the four houses we went to, the sister and a mother said they didn't even get a chance to fall in love and have children. And, you know, having children is this big reward in their culture, and I don't know about ours. But they didn't have this chance to do this. And, you know, the tears started coming, and we hear, you know, kids playing in the background, and, you know, they asked, what can we do? What can we do? And, you know, they just wanted me and the people I was with to come back and tell you about their family members and let you know that they're still in jail. Now, at this time, we were hearing on the news about the Hezbollah trade. This trade was a trade of 400 Palestinian prisoners for four Israeli prisoners. Now, the funny juxtaposition of all of this is that 400 people were arrested a month before, and they were releasing 400 people that would have been released anyway within the next year. So it's not people that had been there for 18 years. It wasn't the families' relatives being released. These were people that would have gotten out. Now, the fifth house we visited was one of the men that had been released in this Hezbollah trade, and he was 18 years old. He was arrested when he was 16, and he was suspected of being part of Hamas. Now, you know, he spoke about his torture in jail, the psychological trauma, and the fact that he would have stayed if somebody else could have gone, because he knew he would have been out in 2 months. This kid had a scholarship to come to Canada. He was going to be an engineer. And he told us just open-heartedly about what he had experienced and the fact that he would have done it all over again if this occupation could end. And he looked at his dad to, you know, ask, what, you know, what else do I say, what, you know, what more? And his father looked at us and said, well, we're going to still make sure we find out what's going on with his life, and we're going to make sure he goes to college and make sure that he lives a good life. And the resilience in this family was amazing. 2 days before he had been released, he was in jail. And it's amazing to see how people can live and still see a future for themselves after an experience like that. I don't know that I could. Now, I'm going to show some slides, and as I go through the slides, I don't have that much time, so I'm going to just tell little blips of stories. But before I do, I just want you to know the overriding theme that I saw here was collective punishment. Now, this term is something that I've heard Curry speak about in Iraq, and it's something that happens over and over again with mass arrests of innocent people, young people, prolonged curfews, house demolitions, road closures, roadblocks, checkpoints, and the demolishing of sacred places. And this has happened multiple times in Palestine. So the similarities are obvious, and collective punishment is the punishing of a whole group of people and not just the individual that committed the crime. So I'm going to go through this and just try to give you blurbs of what's going on in some of these pictures and some information, and just let you know that we pay for everything that these soldiers do in Israel and in Iraq. Our money is going there. $6.3 billion of U.S. tax dollars go to Israel a year. And we have, I think it's $13 billion of military contracts out right now that will be given to Israel. And the Palestinian police officers don't even carry guns. So this is the really uneven balance that we're talking about here. So I'm going to try to give you all an eyewitness to the occupation so that you can see for yourselves what I saw. And the pictures are not, you know, any photojournalistic expertise by any means. Now, the people that benefit, one second, let me. The people that benefit are corporations like Caterpillar in the United States, the military-industrial complex, and the settlers. And I'll talk more about the Israeli settlers in a minute. I don't know how great this picture came out, but it's a picture. It's a picture of military officers in front of McDonald's in a bus station. And I just thought it was really comical having McDonald's juxtaposed to the military officers. They were coming for a break and, you know, to get a snack. Okay, all of the triangles you see here are within the West Bank. The green line separates the West Bank from Israel proper, and the triangles are the settlements. So that's a lot of settlements. Just to keep that in mind, to give you some context, I was only in the West Bank. You had to get a permit to get to Gaza.
So the triangle's different than what the little key says? The key says closer checkpoint.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, this is correct. I am wrong. Thank you. There's another map. Deir Balut, this is a village where there's been lots of different initiatives made to try to stop the wall that's going to be built, and they uproot olive trees so that they can build the wall. And this is what it looks like after they bulldoze olive trees. And that's what they use to uproot the olive trees and also to demolish homes. This actually was outside of Bethlehem at a checkpoint. Ida Camp is a refugee camp that suffers greatly from the occupation right now. We were there for 2 days and got to see the families of the victims. This little boy was outside of the house that got demolished. The inside of this house, I'm sorry it was black and white, but the inside of the house was completely trashed, and the man in the background was trying to salvage anything possible because his cousin had been shot the day before by the Israeli Defense Force that came in undercover. His cousin shot back at the Israeli Defense Force and wounded 4 of the soldiers. He was killed and 3 people were arrested. The rag hanging on the door was bloodied, and this little boy is holding shells from the gun. This is his home, completely shot up. We got an, I don't know if it was an opportunity, but we sat with the widow who had just been beaten up the day before, and we sat in mourning with her for about 20 minutes, and I don't speak Arabic, and it was just a really intense feeling in the room with all women just sitting and being with each other. Her home was demolished, and something about home demolitions is there's no credit in Palestine. You can't just go get a credit card and put your house on credit. Everything that you've ever made, everything that your family has ever made goes into building your home. So when it's demolished, you have nothing. And if you have an opportunity to build it again, you build it more beautiful as a show of resistance, to show you cannot defeat me, you cannot tear down my home and, you know, wipe me out. So, you know, this woman is suffering at the time from exactly that, a loss of just everything, including her husband. This is a small village outside Ramallah. The people there were amazing, and it's a beautiful village. This is what it looks like. There's a road that goes to Ramallah that would take about 20 minutes to get to, but they can't drive on that road, the people that live in this village, because it's the road for the settlers. It takes 45 minutes for them to get into Ramallah, and even if there's an ambulance or an emergency, they have to go on this really sketchy road. And you know, just think, your kids get sick, you need to go to a doctor. There's not a doctor or a clinic or anything in this village, so 45 minutes it takes to get to the doctor's office. And in the outskirts, it's really hard to see. Anything white you see on the outskirts of this picture are settlements. And on the very far right, up in the hill, is a settlement. It completely surrounds the village. There's just, you know, they're everywhere. And this was going into Algenia. You can see the Israeli flag on the home. They've taken over this home. And this is a 1,000-year-old olive tree that often gets demolished at the whim of Israeli soldiers and at the expense of US tax dollars. Now, Hebron is a whole different story. It is surrounded. Hebron in 1994, there was a shooting in a mosque. 29 people were killed, and that brought many different internationals to be observers and to stop some of the violence. This is Hebron's marketplace, a complete ghost town. There was nothing going on there. And this is what you see above you in the marketplace. Above you are the settlers, and they'll throw bricks and rocks down onto this, onto the marketplace, and you know it's pretty much closed. I think I bought a little bag, and it was the first thing the guy had sold in 2 weeks. Now you can see this Israeli school behind the village. It's completely protected, and the military is everywhere. We were talking to the Christian Peacemaker team that does a lot of nonviolent intervention, walks people through checkpoints, intervenes physically with their bodies between settlers and Israeli settlers and Palestinians to separate people and to separate military from the Palestinians if they do see abuse happening. They told many stories of that. Okay. Bethlehem. They're building the wall. They were attempting to build the wall with the mayor outside of the wall. So, you know, it's crazy. This is what you see when you're going into Bethlehem. These are the checkpoints, the 18-year-old soldiers with machine guns and their finger on the trigger. This is a settlement outside of Bethlehem, and it's completely taken over a huge green space, which obviously now is not a green space. This is where some people live. And this is not where we stayed. We stayed in different homes. We stayed with a teacher that is teaching children. Her name is Susan Atala. And she went to St. Michael's, actually. And she's teaching kids English, and she's writing life stories of these children. And the life stories consist of this occupation and tanks and death and destruction of their families. And it's kind of a therapy to be able to express what's going on in their lives. And they're publishing the book, so they'll hopefully have it. Now, this is Qalqilya, what I spoke about. And the wall is disgusting. And these are the people that live behind the wall. And guy right there, he works with ISM and has been the field director in that area. He's speaking Arabic to the kids. And now this is Hillary. She'll be back in town hopefully soon. And that's the wall. And the farm on this side of the wall, the farmer on this side of the wall can't get to his crops on the other side of the wall. Sometimes he can leave through the checkpoint, and the checkpoint, the military gets to decide, you know, if you have a donkey today, you can go through. If you have a tractor today, you can go through. Only you can go through, so you have to carry everything that you harvest back over here. And today, maybe you won't be able to go through, and your crops will die, and you won't be able to make any money. So it's really putting an economic stranglehold on Palestinians. This wall is strangling the livelihood and the hope of any economic survival of many of the people behind it. This is graffiti on the wall after a demonstration. And they let people know that mortal danger is ahead of them. It's very nice, you know, many different languages just in case. It's just the same picture. I had to do it again.
Is that a caterpillar?
It is a caterpillar. Now, we went to a demonstration in Abu Dis. I know I'm out of time, so I'll try to go quick. Thousands of people, internationals, Palestinians, and Israelis came together to protest against the wall. The wall is being built. It's definitely creating ghettos throughout all of Palestine. And that you can see the beginning and the end of walls and how it cuts off people literally from the other side and from water. That's the water tank on the other side of the wall. Saturday at noon at the top of Church Street, there's a vigil and a march in remembrance of Rachel Corrie, who was part of the International Solidarity Movement. And March 20th, I can put that down, back up for you. And this is just other resources that you can look at. I just want to say before I finish, I'm sorry it took so long, that what is needed is a lot more than internationals going abroad and saying that this occupation is wrong. Because you know, the thing that internationals can do is they can inspire people, they can give hope, and they can give the oppressor some choices because it kind of gives a block. We can teach the outside world about what's going on behind those walls. We can provide resources, financial resources, that many people are unable to get. We can help people get to hospitals because accompanying ambulances is a really important need because sometimes the ambulance just won't be able to get through the checkpoint and the person will die inside the ambulance, or the baby won't be born correctly. We can do campaigns at home. There's many different campaigns that are happening all across the United States. I'm working on a campaign for a new foreign policy because our foreign policy obviously doesn't work. We can lobby, and we can do creative acts of resistance. We saw in the slideshow spray painting. The theater troops that come out of Ida Camp are phenomenal. They've gone international and shown what's happening on a daily basis inside their camps. They play the martyr. They play the stone thrower in the plays so that they don't act it out in real life. So they can actually vent their anger in a way that's productive and provides options for people. That's what's happening there. We can do the same thing here because I'm angry and I need a place to put it. We can help rebuild homes, or we could raise money to rebuild homes. And some of the things that I found in talking with people that are doing this kind of work is that it's really hard to leave. And a lot of people have been there a really long time and are still, you know, working with communities. But something that I think is important is to come home and talk to people and let them know what really is going on there. And if we stay too long, people become dependent and expect internationals to be there. We need to empower ourselves to change our government, and we need to empower people in these occupied territories to take actions against their oppressor. And we need to learn how to use the media in many different ways. Free Radio Burlington here locally has been doing that, and the public television station here also has been doing that. But internationally, we need to figure out methods of using the media and changing international perceptions of what's going on all over the world. So I just out of respect for the people that I've met there, and for Abed, who is doing a lot of community building in Ida Camp, and we hope that he'll be here April 21st. It's in the visa process, and Nancy Farrell is trying to get him over here to speak. He wrote a poem, and I want to read it to you guys. They came in the night, covered by dark colors, whispering their hate to every corner of the streets and the houses in Ida Camp. They came at 1 o'clock in the morning, thinking that conscious eyes are sleeping. They came with their last edition arms, their latest edition of arms and war machines. They came to awaken the hidden emotions. They came as they came every time, demolish a shelter where every family hide its pain, misery, and dreams of freedom, dreams of an awakening justice and the silence of the silence. They came as only occupation army knows how to come, sneaking like thieves of lost kingdoms, no barriers, no limits to the ugliness of their violence. All humanity seem handicapped before them. Justice closes its eyes as well as human looks. No environmental concerns for all the uprooted trees and destroyed stolen lands. No laws apply, no resolutions, no protected heritages, no life for the weak, for the abandoned victims. Occupiers have no shame. And the last quote that he has here is, "Let us teach our children how to love the Israeli occupier, and how to bow before its democracy, and how to write beautiful poems and love peace, justice, and dreams of simple humans. May your days be more beautiful than our days, and most importantly, than our nights." And that's